morning, early birds. You've caught the Worm, a podcast from Yellowstone Public Radio, rounding up reporting from our newsroom and Montana Public Radio. The Montana University System urges changes to the fall semester schedule, testing for COVID-19 in the Fort Belknap Indian community, and the mail-in June 2nd primary election. It's Monday, May 18th. I'm your host, Jess Sheldahl. A federal agency agreed to temporarily limit how and where it kills wildlife that threaten livestock in Montana. The U.S. Department of Agriculture reached the settlement in federal court with Wild Earth Guardians Thursday. Rachel Kramer reports.
The USDA's Wildlife Services will spend the next year studying the environmental effects and risks of the practices it uses to kill predators in the state. During the interim, Wildlife Services agreed to halt its use of M44s on Montana's public lands and in more than 40 counties. Critics say the controversial spring-loaded devices intended to poison predators are unnecessary risks to wildlife and the public. The settlement on Thursday comes after Wild Earth Guardians sued Wildlife Services in November 2019, saying the agency used outdated environmental reviews of its work. As part of the settlement, Wildlife Services will stop using certain types of snares and traps. It also agreed not to kill wildlife in designated areas like wilderness and wild and scenic river corridors. Wildlife Services will also release yearly reports of its wildlife control. It will include the number and type of animals captured and reason given for their lethal removal. With Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Rachel Kramer.
A Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks official says a mother grizzly bear attacked a boater who inadvertently came between the parent and her cub. The Great Falls Tribune reports a helicopter transported the man to a hospital for treatment of non-life-threatening injuries following the attack yesterday morning. A Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Department spokesperson says the man was a member of a group taking boats down the Sun River. He was attacked after he stepped to some bushes without being aware of the animals and put himself between the cub and the female, who attacked and bit the man. Montana's Commissioner of Higher Education is calling on the state's universities and colleges to consider modifying their schedules to finish out next fall semester early before a possible second wave of the novel coronavirus. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton has more.
Commissioner Clayton Christian suggested Thursday that Montana schools should begin their fall semesters early and end them by November 25th, when flu season and potentially COVID-19 spread could pick up. University of Montana announced that it's working on its academic calendar for the fall and will announce any changes in the coming days. Montana State University announced the first day of the fall semester will be August 17th. 2 weeks earlier than its normal start time. Currently, enrollment for fall semester is down significantly compared to last year. MSU also announced this week that all staff will transition back to working on campus June 1st. Aaron Bolton, Montana Public Radio News.
Montana is reporting 468 cases of the COVID-19 illness as of this morning, with 21 active cases in the state. Bighorn County currently has the most active cases with 6. Testing is ramping up as some places like the Fort Belknap Indian community begin expanding testing to people who aren't showing symptoms. It's part of an effort to determine if the virus is spreading asymptomatically in the state. Governor Steve Bullock recently set a goal to run 60,000 tests per month. The state health department reports nearly 27,000 tests have been run to date, including some at private laboratories. Last week, we checked in with 3 Billings restaurant owners about how they stayed afloat during Montana's month-long business closure order. In this week's Flavor Moment, Stella Fong heads back to Bistro Enzo, Buffalo Block, and Fancy Sushi Asian Fusion to hear how the first week back to sit-down dining went.
With bars and restaurants reopening, how was business? Chef James Honecker shares.
The first day back was good. Lots of regular customers who braved out.
Those who came found changes.
we can't just do one time frame anymore. This restaurant was famous for doing 5:45 to 6:45, but we can't do that anymore. So people are adjusting to eating a little bit earlier or a little bit later because we only take 18 people per half hour, so that the restaurant never has more than 50 or so people. The rule is 6 feet between people. The way the dining room's set up, there's more than 6 feet on a lot of tables because you just can't fit anything between two tables. So that's just the way it is. We are using upstairs, and the restaurant sat 148. Now it's sitting about 70.
Aside from more space, new sanitation procedures have been put in place.
We're using two, they're called back waiters, but one of them's job is to, whenever they're not busy, which is a lot of the time if there's two, they have a checklist of things to clean.
Along with more stringent cleaning procedures, the wait staff is wearing masks.
That's a strange thing, to be in the dining room with all the wait staff wearing masks.
Honecker's reopening with help with money through the Paycheck Protection Program.
You have to use 75% of your loan for payroll. I would say all but a couple are back. Some are working reduced hours, but they still get unemployment.
In adhering to the health rules for reopening, costs have been incurred.
I know what our fixed costs are per month because I learned in April, and we're not going to make it up this year. That's the truth. But perhaps we can break even this year.
We now go downtown to Buffalo Block, where the community also came out to support the business. General Manager Mitch Fox says of his staff.
And as far as our change, our crew had nothing but positive attitude towards all of the changes. Obviously, they want to be safe themselves. They want to make sure our guests are safe.
Buffalo Block opened at the end of last year and was just getting into its business stride.
How much is it really going to affect us? I don't know. Based on what I'm seeing now and based on what I'm seeing, you know, our seating capacity, my best guess is we're probably going to max out at about a third of what we would potentially be able to do.
And why is that?
We've lost a fair amount of seating, and I think beyond just the seating capacity that we've lost, the bar is a huge impact. And when you don't have people coming out and patronizing the bar, and especially this time of year with the patio, I would expect to be congregating around our fireplace. Additionally, that doesn't even take into account our banquet business. So, I mean, if you look at the whole kit and caboodle, we may be at, you know, 25% or even less.
Restaurants are facing uncertain and challenging times. Jimmy Lee of Fancy Sushi Asian Fusion did not reopen and continued takeout.
That was Stella Fong of Flavors Under the Big Sky. Hear Stella break down Montana's food scene every third Monday of the month on Yellowstone Public Radio. This weekend, the Assiniboine and Gros Ventre tribes of the Fort Belknap Indian community tested more than 1,000 people for the COVID-19 illness. The expanded testing is part of a broader push to find out where the disease might be in Montana and captured a snapshot ahead of one of the community's first social events in weeks. Holly Michaels of the Helena Independent Record covered the site's kickoff Friday and shares her reporting with Nikki Willett.
Holly, you were there. Can you help me picture what this is and how it works?
Yeah, so what it is across the street in this park that's across the street from some tribal health offices and some college buildings, they set up this two-lane sort of drive-through that looks like kind of a fast food restaurant drive-through where people would come in and check in with, they had National Guard members helping out, and then tribal health officials and some IHS officials actually doing the testing, but you'd come in, give some initial information, then go through. People, you know, in full PPE, face masks, lots of protective gear would come up to people's car doors and get information so they can track the test. And then you either had the person sitting in the car or they could hop out if that was easier, but quick nasal swab, get them back in the car and get them on the road. The whole thing looked like, you know, for each car, it took about maybe 5 minutes. And we were at the site for maybe 30, 40 minutes and pretty steady traffic the whole time that we were up there.
This is part of surveillance testing that's being rolled out statewide. What is surveillance testing and why is there so much focus on it right now?
Yeah, so what the testing that we've had to date in Montana has been, you know, people who are symptomatic. You're trying to focus on if you have any of the symptoms of COVID-19, go ahead and get tested. But as we're moving into, you know, this phase one of reopening the state and more people are on about doing things, we're really trying to capture people who might be pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic, because, you know, we know that those people can spread COVID-19 around. So capturing them would be helpful, as we're encouraging, but, you know, letting people go out and do more things in the community. So there's that. And then there's also just an epidemiological value in Montana. The more people we test, the more we know about what's going on and the prevalence of virus in certain communities. So kind of as we're entering this new phase, just being able to get these snapshots in time of what it looks like is super helpful for tracking the virus in Montana.
Governor Steve Bullock has said surveillance testing is being targeted in certain communities in the state, including long-term care facilities, nursing homes, but also tribal communities. Why was Fort Belknap chosen as one of these early sites for surveillance testing rollout?
So part of it, like you just said, Nikki, is governor's priority is looking at these communities. But Fort Belknap was also ready to, you know, have one of these sites roll out. The tribe, tribal government, tribal president Andy Work said today that he, along with the tribal health department there, had already passed a resolution that set up their own testing protocols that they wanted to move toward in terms of surveillance testing. And they had already entered this first tier of that, where they wanted to test some of the more at-risk people in their community.
What were you hearing just about the layout of the community?
So from the Tribal Health Department and then Indian Health Services representative up there, they talked a lot about, you know, there's at-risk people are a little more prevalent in our tribal communities. One person I interviewed said, it wouldn't be an exaggeration to say every household on their reservation has someone at risk. There's a lot of pre-existing health conditions in reservation communities. And then there's a lot of also, you know, a lot of generations living under one roof. We know older people are at higher risk for bad outcomes from COVID-19. So if you've got younger people out, you know, in the community and taking home and grandma's living there, you know, they're at higher risk. I think some people up there today also talked to me a little bit about just the housing stock and how it's not really well situated. You've got a lot of like 3-bedroom, 2-bath households that are shared by a lot of people. And you hear a lot like, oh, if you've got a master bedroom and bathroom, that's how you would isolate. But that's just not the reality of how people live in that community.
So Fort Belknap still has a stay-at-home order that's in place, you know, even after the state has lifted theirs. Are people taking it seriously?
Yeah, they are. I didn't see a single person up there today not wearing a mask. And you know, everybody working at the site and a fair number of people who are coming in too were wearing them. I think what's interesting up there in the community, people I spoke with said that graduation is Saturday, and that, you know, they think on one hand it's going to be a draw to get people in to get tested. But even with this distance, the ceremony that's going to have socially distant measures in place, there's still an acknowledgement people will probably get together for barbecues, family gatherings. And so they're pretty curious about what this surveillance testing might show. You know, the hope always is that, you know, very few to no cases. But given this weekend that has potential for people to be kind of mingling with each other, they're really looking for what this snapshot in time might be and how it might play out over time. You know, there's no cases, they might feel a little more comfortable about those gatherings people have. If there's, you know, prevalence of them in the community, this gives them a good chance to sort of track how those ceremonies might have spread them.
Thank you, Holly.
Yeah, thanks, Nikki.
That was Holly Michaels of the Helena Independent Record. You can find her story on Fort Belknap's surveillance testing at helenair.com. Montana counties have sent ballots for the June 2nd primary to every single active voter across the state. Elections administrators have embraced the so-called all-mail election because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Kevin Trevlin asked various county officials how they're handling the abrupt shift. He shares his reporting with Nikki Ouellette.
Kevin, who made the call to go to an all-mail primary?
Well, Nikki, Governor Steve Bullock used emergency powers in late March, allowing counties to decide whether they want to conduct an all-mail primary. Since then, every single one of Montana's 56 counties chose to go that route. County officials say it was an obvious choice to limit the spread of COVID-19. Here's Brett Rutherford, Yellowstone County's elections administrator.
So it was kind of a no-brainer for Yellowstone County. The fact that you would have to recruit and staff large polling places with 200 and some judges during a pandemic, it's just not optimal to put people in one spot together like that. So it was an easy decision for us.
How will this all-mail election actually work?
Well, ballots must be returned to county elections offices by 8 p.m. on Election Day, June 2nd. Return postage is included with each ballot, so it won't cost voters anything to mail those envelopes. Almost 600,000 ballots were mailed May 8th, so most active voters should have theirs by now. They can check the Secretary of State's My Voter page to make sure their address is current in case they haven't received anything. Envelopes include three ballots, one each for the Green, Republican, and Democratic parties, but voters can only fill out and return one. They also need to remember to sign the outside of their envelopes before returning them, otherwise those votes won't be counted.
Is this truly all mail?
Most of the counties I reached out to offer locations for voters to drop ballots off as well. County offices will be open for Election Day drop-offs too, though officials are urging voters to come in earlier to avoid crowding. Also, some counties are operating satellite voting offices on Native American reservations several days per week for voter registration and ballot drop-off. Bighorn County Elections Administrator Dulcie Bear Don't Walk says the satellite offices help rural residents avoid lengthy drives to the county elections office.
Our county is extremely large in landmass and very spread out communities. So for us, the satellite office allows people to be able to come in and cast their ballot ahead of time, especially if they're from, you know, over an hour out.
How are counties preparing for this all-mail election?
It's been a challenge for some officials. Bighorn County doesn't have high absentee votership, so they needed to hire three election judges and increase staff hours to stuff all the extra ballot envelopes in time. For many other counties, the all-mail primary isn't so large a shift from normal operations. For example, 94% of Gallatin County residents already voted absentee during the 2018 primary, so their infrastructure is already in place for the upcoming contest. The bigger difficulty has been staying safe amid COVID-19. Bighorn County ordered, quote, infection protection kits for staff.
What's an infection protection kit?
It's basically an industrial-sized package of wipes, masks, and gloves. Also, Missoula County Elections Administrator Bradley Siemens says they've actually relocated their office in response to the coronavirus.
In our new building, we were fortunate enough to have areas where we could set up two staff to a room and help spread them out. We staggered our times when people came in, and we helped make sure that, you know, no communal potlucks, no big gatherings like that, like we normally like to do for our workers. It was really about making sure that they had an individual space where they could work.
Kevin, what kind of financial impacts are you hearing about moving this election to the mailbox?
Well, most counties say they actually save money voting by mail. Brett Rutherford with Yellowstone County says traditional polling place elections cost about $1.50 per voter, whereas all-mail elections typically cost about $1 per voter. Rutherford says that's because counties don't have to operate polling places or hire as many election judges with all-mail elections. The state is also reimbursing counties on ballot return postage.
What about voter turnout?
There's evidence that mail voting increases it. Most county officials I spoke with expect just that with the upcoming primary. Here's Rutherford again.
It's hard to say, but I wouldn't be surprised if at this primary is probably in the top, you know, four or five as far as turnout all time.
Based on what you're hearing, can we expect more mail voting in the future?
Possibly. Wendy Underhill, an elections expert with the National Conference of State Legislatures, told me that voting by mail is really taking off in certain states. Washington, Colorado, and Utah have all begun voting exclusively by mail in the last decade. Underhill says the upcoming primary could be a sort of case study for Montana, which also has high mail votership.
So I think we could even argue that by doing it for the primary, Montana will have some up close and personal experience from which to judge whether they want to continue using mail voting into the future.
Last week, California became the first state to announce an all-mail general election in November due to COVID-19. We'll see whether Montana makes a similar move.
Interesting. Anything else that Montana voters should know?
County officials recommend that any ballot returned by mail be sent by May 26th to ensure it arrives in time for counting by June 2nd.
So May 26th. Kevin, thanks so much for bringing this information to us.
No problem.
That was Kevin Trevelin sharing his reporting with Nikki Willette. Kevin is YPR's Report for America Statehouse reporter. And that's what's happening in Montana today. Check in with Montana Public Radio's Montana Evening News for updates on the news of the day. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Jess Sheldahl. We'll have another episode of The Worm for You Early Birds tomorrow morning.
The Worm is produced by Jess Sheldahl for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music composed and recorded by Zach Jones at Rapscallion Recording. Metal Art Call captured by Jay McGowan for the Macaulay Library. Partial funding for the worm is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montana. More information about the worm is available at ypradio.org.